I'm very pleased, or perhaps I'm not, to welcome back Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University to view from the Roundhouse today. Martin, welcome, but the world's in a terrible state.
Yes, just to clarify, I presume you're pleased to see me. It's more the topic sounds a bit depressing because not much has changed from about a week ago, in fact, several weeks ago.
You're dead right, Martin. I think we should label today's podcast more of the same. Trump, Iran, a little bit different. We've got our PM making a little announcement. The price of petrol, of course, keeps going up, and mainly that's what Australians are talking about. But as we go to air, Martin, just after midday Thursday in Fremantle, Western Australia, the New York Times is updating its story, which goes like this: Iran war live updates. Trump claims military success, but offers no clear timeline to end fighting. And then they go on to say, in a 19-minute address from the White House, President Trump said the US would hit Iran, quote unquote, extremely hard over the next 2 to 3 weeks, but did not make any revealing announcements. Martin, what do you make of this announcement by Trump? Why has he done it? Do we feel any closer to the end of war?
Well, this is a we've had another extraordinary address this time from Donald Trump. This is where he says that he's going to end the war within 2 to 3 weeks, but he's also unclear about these broader objectives, or also unclear about how the blocking of the Strait of Hormuz might actually be resolved. Bearing in mind, of course, the straits was open when he started this war. And I think that's the unanswered question on a lot of people's minds because it's the material issue that relates to the strangulation of oil supply globally. And that's why we're in a desert, troubled space here in Australia and practically every other country in the world. So that certainly wasn't addressed in that address. And he said that he's going to end the war. But if you're around now and you know you've got 2 to 3 weeks to survive, you probably just sit it out, lob the odd missile, etc., and keep the straits closed, and presumably hope for the best. There's still every chance, though, Michael, that there might be some attempt to the ground at ground troops. He's amassed massive numbers of ground troops in the immediate area for deployment. The problem is, if you're going in with ground troops, how could you ever extricate yourself, guarantee that within a couple of weeks? So there's so many unanswered questions here around this war. And I would say probably that his address, his 19-minute address, has probably confused people more than added clarity.
Martin, I'm sure you're right. In fact, my feeling is that, excuse me, Iran doesn't even need to fire any missiles anymore or send any more drones anywhere. It doesn't have to explode anything. It just needs to put up photographs of things that look like missiles and say, we've got them, and that look like drones and say, we've got them. I think it's enough. They don't need to do a damn thing. This has been the most hopelessly strategized war of all time. Isn't it time, Martin, that somebody who knows how to fight a war, which Trump does not know, in the US speaks up and says something? Why doesn't the top brass say something? Is there not a Stauffenberg amongst them to say, like he tried to Hitler, we're out of here?
You've got to remember that Donald Trump has, in his own cabinet, employed people that are 100% loyal to him, and that none of them will tell him what things that he doesn't want to hear. That's the first thing we need to consider. Secondly, he's also employed a cabinet that has very little experience in public administration in most counts. Not all, but in most counts. And the Secretary of War, no less, has had, in particular, Pete Hegseth, has very little actual experience in running things. Sure, he'd been a soldier, but at the ground level, he was a Fox News anchor, Michael. These are the sorts of people that the closest advisors and literally his Secretary of War. I'll give Marco Rubio a bit more credit. He's had a long political career as Secretary of State, but there's not many others that have a significant experience here. And even in the top levels of the military, there's an expectation that you tell Donald Trump what he wants to hear. So this is why it's quite troubling. And Also, as a military, your job is to enact or implement the strategy that your president, as commander in chief, outlines, Michael. I would not want that job with Donald Trump as president because every time he opens his mouth, there's a different strategy and different reason for starting the war. Was it a nuclear weapon? Was it the overall military capacity of Iran? Is it regime change? All these things have come and went. If it was a military weapon, weren't they obliterated a year ago? Aren't they obliterated now? The military, the nuclear sites. A lot of these things are still really unclear. So I don't envy those people that are trying to strategize underneath Trump either, Michael.
Martin, I'll let our listeners know I was once a Christian. I'm now a non-theist. I was totally outraged, though, I think on everyone's behalf, when I heard Pete Hegseth, the so-called Secretary for War, they haven't officially changed, he's actually the Secretary for Defence, call upon the name of Jesus Christ to justify the continued war and the bringing of violence on the Iranian Republic. I mean, how do Christians respond to that sort of thing? Do we hear anything out of the MAGA Christian right in the US to say, stop doing that, Pete Hegseth? It seems to me to be utterly appalling, utterly inhuman.
I think there's look, there's certainly the Pope has been quite critical of the drive to war and has called for peace a number of times. Of course, he is American, but not in America at the moment, Michael. Certainly, if so, the core base for Donald Trump is probably more evangelical Christians. There was, of course, that sort of prayer ceremony that he had whilst the war was already raging, Michael, in the White House. I just don't think that there's, that's a really unhealthy thing generally to be trying to weaponize Christianity for a war like this. The irony is, I'm sure the Ayatollahs are trying to weaponize Islam for their cause. And it's all nonsense to use this stuff as weaponizing because, that's, it's based on a very perverse interpretation of the scriptures. And lots of people that are Muslims will say, ISIS had nothing to do with Islam. It's about a naked grab for power. It's about weaponizing a religion for that purpose. And I would say the same here in that, you shouldn't be weaponizing religion for war. In fact, I think it should be the opposite. I think Christians around the world should be praying for peace. Praying for de-escalation of this because there are, by conservative estimates, several thousand civilians already that have died in this conflict. More if you include the civilians in Lebanon as well as part of that angle theater of the conflict. It's clearly not in a human sense a positive development.
Martin, it seems Trump doesn't really listen to anybody. You suggested in our last podcast, perhaps to his golf buddies. I wonder what they're saying to him. He seems to have plenty of time to play golf, to go down to the US Supreme Court to watch the judges deciding whether, if you're born in the US, you're a US citizen or not. But the one thing he does seem to take notice of historically is what's going on with the stock market, Martin. And the New York Times, just 2 hours ago, reported that oil prices jump and stocks drop after Trump's White House speech. And it's right across the world. In South Korea, the stocks were down 3% 2 hours ago, the worst in the region. And in the US, the S&P 500 stock futures pointed to a decline of 0.8% when trading resumed. So if he's reading the tea leaves, or at least the stock market, he must be wondering about the efficacy of going and talking about this war that he's hopelessly conducting. I mean, just add some of the little rhetoric, even as he proffered no clear path out of the war and committed to bombing the nation, quote, back to the Stone Ages where they belong, close quote. And I'm inclined to throw a few expletives into this discussion.
I think the thing to remember about Trump is I would say take a lot less notice about what he says, take a lot more notice about what he does, because he often says one thing and does another. So I'll give you an example. The past week he's been talking up the prospect of negotiations with Iran, all the while amassing more and more ground troops in the immediate region. So there's what he says and what he does. A lot of people have interpreted that discussions around peace as n not so much genuine, but really an attempt to calm the markets. So, I think that's how I'd treat a lot of the rhetoric that's coming out at the moment. He's been saying for quite a while that don't mind the Iranians. They're just the last couple of days, Michael. Don't mind the Iranians. They're making some good deals, and then in the next moment, I'm going to bomb them to the Stone Age. So, I think just this is just rhetoric that he's deploying here.
But Martin, if it, as you're half suggesting, is rhetoric to in a sense, to waylay the Iranian government into not thinking there's going to be a ground war, then that would be the worst possible thing, wouldn't it? American troops step onto the Iranian soil, all hell will break loose. And why wouldn't that bring Russia and even possibly the other loose allies of Iran into what becomes a global war? I don't want to sound alarmist, I don't want to sound pessimistic. I'm not even mentioning the words nuclear armaments at this point, but I'm have to say, as a poor old Australian citizen living on the West Coast, rather seriously worried about what's going to happen here.
Yeah, I think it's another whole risk level to have actual ground troops going in. I imagine he's not thinking about a widespread venture, but rather very pointed or targeted, such as trying to take Kerguelen, which is at the main oil export area for Iran. But even so, even on a small limited scale, the potential for things to go wrong is pretty enormous. So if you're Iran, you've been thinking about this and preparing about this for a good few weeks at least. I'd expect they've got contingencies. There was a piece I was listening, I think it might have been ABC's Planet America, and they had a retired general on it, Michael, and he said one thing that's very poignant. You know what he said? He said, in all of your strategizing, just remember your opponent has a voice too. And it sort of reinforced that actually, you just might want to think about what's on their mind and what they're going to do in all of this, because I'm just not sure that was properly calculated at the outset of this war.
Absolutely wasn't. The other thing that worries me is that it seems that not only has the world order generally been thrown out, but so have the rules of war. I mean, Trump is saying if there's no deal made, he'll hit Iran's electricity grid. And as legal experts point out, this would be a violation of the Geneva Convention. You don't go in and beat up civilians in war. I mean, sometimes they get hit on the side, but you don't use that as a strategy of war. I really have this sense that the old-fashioned rules of war that have been with us since Grotius and the middle of the Middle Ages, Martin, are going out the window.
Yeah, I'm not sure the Geneva Convention's front of mind for Donald Trump, probably. Look, it would be a massive call for him to go after energy infrastructure. That would be another whole level entirely. Of course, in line with the last comment, you might want to think about what Iran does. And if Iran targeted, say, the water infrastructure of those Gulf states, that would be an horrendous outcome for the whole region. So you're talking about, something that might take years to rebuild. And then there's, of course, the energy infrastructure that from Gulf regions and Saudi Arabia and other places. So there's a big risk in that strategy.
Martin, one thing is for sure that whilst I was once on the side of awarding Donald Trump the Nobel Peace Prize, there's no way he'll be getting this year's Nobel Peace Prize. Martin, but how are we in Australia dealing with this? We've had our Prime Minister come out last night, 7 o'clock Australian Eastern Time, 4 o'clock here in Frio, in a funny little recorded address to us all. He didn't mean to have a smile on his face, I don't think, but he was trying, I suppose, to exude calmness and let's hang in here together as the price of petrol goes up.
So, we've got some interesting decisions over the past week. We had a slashing of the fuel excise tax, 26 cents a litre. There's some movement at state level to hand back some of the tax. They've had a bit of a windfall because they tax at 10%, which is, different to the way the federal tax is calculated. So they've actually been getting more. So they're going to hand some of that back, etc. So we're seeing some slight relief at the Bowser. But when you've got a supply problem because of an overheated demand, so demand is exceeding supply, just cutting the fuel excise doesn't do anything except perhaps increase demand. So it might be a popular policy, and who doesn't want their fuel to be a bit cheaper? But does it actually solve the problem? Clearly not. Like I said, it might be popular, although I'm even seeing feedback that it's not nearly enough, Michael. So you can't, even then, they can't win, can they? Clearly, some means of getting people to use less fuel at the moment is pretty essential.
Well, as the Prime Minister, I think, rightly says, this doesn't really matter what happens, is not a set of problems that's going to resolve itself easily, even if the war were to end tomorrow. And that's not plainly not going to happen. You still have to get the oil out. We don't have a full sense, I suppose, of exactly what effect on oil this war has had so far. We need to get it here. I guess it's right of the PM to try and quieten the horses.
Yeah, look, I think he's keeping people calm is actually really important because it's panicked behaviour that has caused an immediate short-term problem. Supply, we're told, is holding up from what it was. It's panic buying, so it does make sense for him to calm the horses. But if he can't find any other means of keeping demand under control, then he's got to consider more extreme measures. So I don't know if we've heard the last of this, particularly if this conflict doesn't die down. And if something does happen, like the severe damaging of energy infrastructure in the Middle East, then we know we've got a real problem. And I wouldn't be surprised to see the government taking more concrete steps here.
It's an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, people who are terribly worried about climate change, and it's something to be terribly worried about, sometimes won't fly because they don't want to leave a carbon print. And now we've got some similar sort of issue. Is it morally right to catch a plane from Perth to Melbourne, as I'm thinking of doing, to catch up with my American friends who are flying in, to hold their hands and talk about what it part of state the world is in? I mean, all these sort of pressures, Martin, people are going to be feeling them. And at the same time, there's increasing attention being given by the media to people who say, well, look, my job is looking precarious. And we will all recall, I think, how during COVID, the government, national government, basically paid people wages, even though they weren't doing anything.
Yeah, well, that might be some way off, but I do think that spectre of rising prices across the board would worry the Prime Minister. And because, I mean, we already had a problem with cost of living, if you recall, even before this happened. So it's not going to get better or get much worse if this conflict continues, because every element of the other supply could change, most notably the food supply chain. But also materials for manufacturing and other places will be impacted by this. So, the flow-on effects could be enormous.
Martin, we have in recent podcasts wondered what would be in Jim Chalmers' May budget. I'd thought that he might do some quite progressive things on the tax front while he had the opportunity. But I suppose as things get worse, the idea is currently being floated on top of everything else, there'd be a 25%. Tax on gas exports from Australia, LNG, might just all be too complicated. You, in a sense, not only have to keep the horses quiet, but sort of lock them into the stables. You don't want to do anything when something like this is happening. Might be the natural inclination of the Treasurer. Sit tight because you might have to spend a lot of money on just supporting the Australian economy.
Yeah, that's true. I think it might put in the back burner some more reform, but certain types of reform, Michael, might be helpful. So, for instance, the capital gains tax, reform, it's still every bit as relevant because the cost of living is still high and housing is still very unaffordable. Actually, that would bring in more income to the government at a time when it really needs it. I think there is some serious consideration around the taxing of gas exports as well. So that's the other one that's risen in recent times, particularly as the margins have improved enormously during this crisis for oil. So I think there's a couple of areas that could increase revenue at a time when the government does really need to support people.
Martin, we've said each week, taking Trump's word at the very outset that this is going to last 2 or 3 weeks. This attack on Iran—it seemed to be a naive thought that a little bit like in Venezuela, they could conduct the equivalent of a quick, sharp kidnapping, decapitate a few leaders, hit a few bombs in strategic places, and the white flags would go up, and the reasonable citizenry of Iran would storm the halls of government and take control, maybe even bring the Shah's son back to run the government again. Could never imagine that happening. But it's gone on and on and on and on, Martin. What is the best way you think this could possibly, and realistic way this could possibly unfold towards something that looks like a ceasefire or peace over the next few weeks?
Well, I think what a lot of people would like to see is obviously a significant peace agreement that would ensure that fighting doesn't just break out again. So that would include the opening of up of the Straits of Hormuz for shipping. That would include the Iran pulling back from its proxies because they have been very destabilizing across the whole region. It would include assurances for Iran that US and Israel wasn't going to be attacking them again. There would include some agreement on Iran's nuclear program. Those are the things that I think people would think are essential ingredients. So I'd encourage everyone out there to look at those ingredients and see whether actually, when you hear a declaration of victory shortly by Donald Trump, see whether those issues are actually addressed.
Well, I'm sure people are going to be going back and looking closely at Barack Obama's arrangements with Iran. Trump never liked them, always thought they were too weak, and I think he always wanted to go in and do what he's doing now. But really, scholars and people looking back in 10, 20, 30, 50 years' time are going to wonder why on earth this happened, Martin.
Yeah, I think there will be some much debate amongst historians one day on this particular conflict. I hope it's a blip. What would be much worse is if they were to look back at this conflict and see it as a precipitator of greater conflicts, Michael. And that's the thing a lot of us have been worried about because there are increased tensions across the board, and some of them involve major players. For instance, I don't think many of us would like to see US and Russia in direct conflict. I think that would get very ugly. And of course, US and China. So they're the things down the track that you would be hoping to avoid.
But Martin, I have little doubt that once this is all over, Australia will have to treat the United States as not a good ally, and we're going to have to ask ourselves in the future: do we really want to do business or diplomacy on a whole range of matters with the United States? And of course, exactly the same questions are being asked about the EU and the future of NATO. It has to be seen, doesn't it? The US is an unreliable partner right now. And if that's the case, really we have to say, do we not? We're not going to do business with them unless we can see some reliability in their future actions.
Well, this will be the really profound thing, I think. It's not just about this war, but it's the entire Trump presidency. And this is the latest and probably the most provocative point in that presidency. But let's be honest, it's been a fair while coming. There's been plenty of insults of other NATO leaders. There's been Trump baiting them for not paying enough. There's been Trump's reluctance to sort of really weigh into Ukraine in the same fashion as his predecessor. There's a lot of slights of other allies by social media, including Japan and Australia. And if Albanese is correct and there's never been an actual request for us to help, so you don't tell your ally that you're going in or ask them or consult with them. You don't actually ask them to do something specific and then you bag them out for not helping. I mean, these things are not going to create good blood, are they?
They're not, Martin. In ordinary civilian life, sometimes good friends fall out, and they're no longer on the Christmas party invitation. And it's quite a serious thing. You don't want to have anything to do with them. Do you foresee something like that happening here?
Look, there are really long-standing and deep US-Australian partnerships that go well beyond the actual president and prime minister. That's the thing to keep in mind here, in terms of predicting some kind of break in the short term. But what it does do is undermine trust. And trust is an intangible there that's really important in the international sphere. It just means, the next time the US asks us for something, how are we going to receive? Respond. Are we going to look to deal with the US next time on a given issue? Will we look for other partners as well? We've just signed a free, here's an example. We just signed a free trade agreement with the EU that's happening on top of new tariffs from the US. So there's going to be a lot of examples here where Australia, it's not like a straight break, we suddenly become best mates with China or Russia, but just looking for new allies and new friends where we previously relied on the US.
Oh, Martin, I'm going to have to go out and have a stiff, strong cup of black tea, I think, to deal with all of this. Look, we'll be back, unfortunately. We'll be back to discuss the same issues over the next number of weeks, but let's hope we start to see sort of some outbreak of something that looks like the beginnings of something that might be called peace in Iran.
Very much so. I hope that there's something positive to report on next week. That would be nice. Not holding out too much hope.
No, well, let's hope that there's a little bit of peace and hope at Easter, and I'll see you next week, Martin.
A pleasure as always, Michael.